Okay. So we started a discussion, was it last Thursday? And we had a lot of people talking about the nature of the deformations that occur, the sort of nature of the types of instability, whether that would occur near the glass transition. And I'm going to sort of try to pick up from there, even though many people are new. And we had a very lively discussion at that point. And so we'll see where it goes today. Work I'm going to show, I just want to mention, was done with this cast of characters, some of whom have already spoken here in the past weeks, including Jorg and Rob Hoy and Craig. So the first thing that I want to talk about is what the nature of the yield criterion might say about the nature of the deformations that occur. So when we write down a yield criteria for material, we typically use the pressure. What is that? Yeah, there we go.
I can keep people in mind.
Then this is the pressure, and then we have things like the von Mises stress, which is constructed from the difference between the principal stresses, and or the maximum difference between the principal stresses, and criteria have been built on both of those. So if you remember, the von Mises criterion is based on the fact that the elastic energy stored from shear scales like this, and so if you think that somehow the energy, when the energy exceeds some threshold, yield will occur, then you would expect that this might control the yield. The Tresca and the Moore-Coulomb criterias look more at this, and they tend to be based on the idea, the Moore-Coulomb in particular, you think about friction and you think about the finding the direction in space where the tangential stress divided by the normal stress is largest, then the idea is you should get yield along the plane where that ratio of shear to normal stress is largest when that ratio exceeds something like the coefficient of friction. Okay? So the physical ideas behind these are very different. This maximum shear stress enters naturally if you think about plane over plane sliding, and this is really an energy criterion, okay? You might hope that which one works would tell you something. Unfortunately, neither of them work too simply. Certainly the von Mises criterion, you start from this idea that you get yield when you exceed some threshold value of this, and then you discover that you have to let that threshold value vary linearly with pressure. And unfortunately, as soon as you've done that, then this is no longer an energy criterion anymore. You can do something similar where you put in a bulk modulus and really try to keep the energy, and it doesn't fit as well, okay? So unfortunately, even though that was the idea, it's not really what ends up.
So Tazio always fixed that.
Yeah, so this would be, this would just say that the threshold depends linearly on pressure with that two constants,
right.
Zero pressure and that, yeah. Okay?
There is no notion of time here at all.
At the moment, we'll talk to it. Yeah. So then you can look at what you find and see how the results compare to experiments. These are some results from Jorg and I. These are experiments on a range of polymers, and the von Mises criterion ends up giving you an ellipse. It would be a circle if you didn't have that pressure dependence, but the fact that there is a pressure dependence means it's harder to yield under compression than it is under under tension.
Okay, sigma 1 and sigma 2
are... This is biaxial loading conditions. So you have the third principal stress is 0, and the you're looking at the yield surface as a function of those two. Thank you.
And each one of those points is a single experiment.
Is a single experiment varying the stress in a particular way. Is there something?
Let's focus on...
Oh, thank you. Right, so in principle, you have three principal stresses, and you can vary any of them, and in any keep them in any proportion, and you'll get yield as you increase, you know, the magnitude of those three stresses. So this is uniaxial tension. You'd keep two of them equal to 0, and you would get just one of them non-zero. So uniaxial tension test, this would be uniaxial tension and uniaxial compression. And this is just the surface varying the ratio of those two stresses, okay? And if you had the Tresca or more Coulomb, you would get straight lines, okay? Those are the Tresca and more Coulomb predictions. And clearly the simulations don't look like that. They're much closer to the ellipse.
And the range of temperatures, so that means it's pretty much independent of temperature.
This yes, so here we've gone from 10 to the minus 2 to 0.3, okay? And I've just, in each case, collapsed the results by the value there. So there's one scaling.
The units of temperature, the depth of the temperature.
So this is a Leonard Jones simulation of, and I've got results here. This is, okay. I have two cases, binary Leonard Jones. This is not exactly Kolb Anderson. I can't remember. I think we're using the parameters that Michael originally used.
Wattstrom.
No. Wasn't there something earlier when...
Oh, a two-dimensional one?
No. I think it's the one you first did in your thesis, which wasn't Cobb Anderson, but okay. Anyway, it's in the paper. It doesn't matter.
That's effectively blanked out, isn't it?
Okay. Never mind. And we also have on here short and long chains. So these are polymers. They're Leonard-Jones interactions, and they have an extra bond, covalent bond, keeping them together. Okay, and both of these potentials are the ones that were discussed in previous talks by Jorg Rotler and Rob Hoy. So short and long chains, it doesn't matter for this initial behavior. The length of the chains doesn't matter. Okay. Now, the other thing you asked about this, the glass transition temperature for these models is around 0.3. And so we've gone from way below to about the glass transition temperature. And the results don't care whether it's short chains, binary Leonard Jones, they all show the same behavior, okay? And the experiments are a variety of different real polymeric systems, and again, they show something closer to an ellipse than something like straight lines.
Okay? So when you say yield, what are we seeing as yield? Is it an instability or is it?
This is defined currently as looking at the peak in the stress strain curve, but you get the same result if you use the engineering definition, which is the 0.2% yield criteria. That is the stress at which, if you extrapolate back linearly, there would be a residual strain of 0.2%, okay? So we've done different yield criteria, and the same result applies for all of them, okay? And again, the experiments, I've seen them analyzed in different ways as well. Now, one of the things that people have argued is that part of the reason that this succeeds is there hasn't been a catastrophic failure along a single plane, okay? And if that had occurred, then maybe the Tresca would work. So this is some sort of more homogeneous yield in all these cases. That's just for a binary, a biaxial strain. What about adding a third dimension? Well, it turns out that if you look at all cases moving in all combinations in three dimensions of the strain curve, including all the cases I've just shown, then you get nice linear scaling of the yield stress with the pressure. And that's just that von Nice criterion saying there should be a linear dependence. Now, part of the reason I want to show that is there's this nice slope, and I think that it has meaning. There's something different that happens at negative pressures. This is cavitation, okay? Everywhere else it's failing by shear. So what determines the threshold at zero pressure and then the dependence on pressure?
In the data that you show, you also have points that fall on that line which are at negative pressure.
Right, so you can go to negative pressure and still have it fail under shear, okay? So the actual point where you transition from that shear mode of failure to cavitation, you know, it's always at some negative load, and that can depend a little bit on rate and time, et cetera, because it's a nucleation process, but it's a fairly weak thing. I wasn't planning to talk about that. So, what determines that slope? Well, one of the things that we did was we took the Leonard-Jones potential and we varied the cutoff. So you can go from a purely repulsive interaction and include more and more of the tail, okay? You can also work at a range of pressures. And this just shows that results for all three of those cutoffs.
These are sharp cutoffs?
These are sharp cutoffs. And the potential is truncated and shifted in this particular case. So the potential is shifted to be zero at the point where you truncate it, although that's not true.
I know you didn't want to talk about that, but
yeah.
just to pick some idea in my head. So, I mean, in principle, when I'm applying negative stress, the solid that I'm looking at is, I mean, if I'm thinking in thermodynamic terms, it is sort of higher free energy, presumably, both with the fluid, which is under tension, and something else. So, I mean, could I think of the first regime as sort of a fluidization induced?
The first regime meaning the one,
right? The top one, yeah. So the one we used on the top.
This one here.
Yes. And this is cavitation is when you basically nucleate.
You really are nucleating holes here. You're lowering the free energy of the system by creating high density and low density phases, paying the cost of the interface.
Right. No, I'm asking, can the other regime can I think of as nucleating a fluid? Or not?
It's not really a fluid in the sense that I'm
a liquid.
I mean liquid versus gas.
This is just the regime where you're beginning to see steady shear of the solid material, and if you stop, it stops. So I wouldn't think of it as a liquid per se.
But if you stop, you lose the stress in such a case.
No, you can keep the stress there, and it won't. It'll creep, and the creep again was discussed by Jorg 2 weeks ago or last week something. But so it's a first order, you keep stress on and you let it sit, and not much will happen in that at that point.
So you're not using yield in the sense of thing has to move.
Well, I am in the sense if I plot a stress strain curve. Okay. This is the danger of deciding you're going to do things really quickly to start a discussion. I'm sorry. I should have known better. Stress, strain, and you look typically something like that. And so I'm plotting this yield stress as this peak, and if I kept going, there'd be a stress. If I kept increasing the strain, the stress would follow this curve. If I stop, the stress.
Perfect.
We just stay. So it's not liquid in the sense that there's no relaxation to zero stress.
It's not also, I mean, you know, the definition of yield stress is when it actually starts to flow. It's not the definition of yield.
Well, it is starting to flow at this stress. If I had did a stress control, right, there's two ways of doing it. I'm doing a strain control simulation. If I did a stress control, then once I hit this point, the stress, it would just go forever. Okay?
So you're saying you stop the strain, the stress is going to remain finite?
It won't relax. That's right. It'll relax, but very slowly, logarithmically with time in an activated way. Okay? So, but what I want to get at here is the fact that independent of the adhesion, which affects tau naught quite a lot, okay, the slope as a function of pressure for all these curves at both temperatures collapses onto a single line, okay? So the slope, the alpha, depends upon the repulsive part of the potential, which is constant, but is independent of the attractive part. And we can do that in other ways, okay? Now, so if we think back to the idea of friction, the simplest picture is that when you want to slide, you've got to lift things up over each other, right? That you've got things interlocked. And in order to slide, you have to lift up against a normal load in order to make things move, okay? And that was the basic idea of Tresca. And the idea there was the failure is really along a plane. And we saw that Tresca didn't really work. It wasn't so simple, okay? But we can see here that it is very much the same sort of idea, that it's harder for the yield to occur through whatever deformation is occurring, the bigger the pressure, because as in granular meter and everything else, we have to dilate, right? We have to somehow make space for things to flow by each other. And the main point that I wanted to get to through all this is that the fact that pressure-modified von Mises occurs tells us that it's not simply a planar type of motion, that the type of space we need to create in order for the deformation to occur has to be more isotropic, has to reflect the pressure coming in from all sides. Otherwise, we would have had the Tresca. So we heard some statements last week about the idea that there might be strings or there might be sort of complex volumes sort of rotating, okay? This kind of result sort of makes sense more if there's some non-planar thing that's involved in our fundamental mechanism of deformation.
But how non-planar would it have to be? Because, I mean, the glass, even if you cut it, it's never quite planar. You always have, because, I mean, it's not a crystal.
Yeah.
So how much fluctuations would you need in order to...
I haven't done anything quantitatively on it, but it seems like it's completely isotropic. The model that says all that matters is the von Mises model has nothing at all about there being any special direction, and it works very well in all the cases that I've showed you under all triaxial conditions. So whether, you know, it could be an ellipse or... I don't know. I just think it's certainly this idea of planes is too simple.
I'm confused again. A lot of the stuff that we've talked about is what I would consider as either a granular solid or colloids or so on. But here you say you've got a covalent bond as well now.
In some of the simulations, but not in others. The Leonard-Jones, there's no covalent bond. The polymers, there is. It doesn't matter, okay? In the small strain limit. Again, Rob Hoy talked about strain hardening at large strains, but in this limit, the initial yield, when we're first seeing flow, sort of macroscopic type of flow, then covalent bonding doesn't matter.
And say differently, you're seeing the same response whether it has covalent bonding or not?
Yes.
If you go to two dimensions, the event, the whatever it is, will change then? Would you see that in the simulation?
The two-dimensional part is yet to come. Okay. So we haven't looked at the actual nature of the deformations in detail, partly because of memory requirements. But what I want to do next, so this is point one. Before I move on, any more questions on this? Yeah?
To confirm that another way of pressure effect affecting the phenomena is through the harmonicity. Like the harmonicity,
yeah.
Simply that the moduli become harder. So this effect is much stronger than this harmonicity effect.
Yes.
By what? Order of magnitude?
Yeah. Yeah, and harmonicity is definitely. Okay. So, what about what happens and where we're beginning to see deformation? So this again is stress versus strain, and what I've been showing you is this value, the peak value in the stress. Okay. And what the engineering criterion is that you go to some point and you ask, when you extrapolate back linearly, would the net strain be 0.2%? It's a wonderfully physical definition.
I'm sorry. Yeah? Linearly with what slope?
With the initial slope. Now, frequently people will say that what you're supposed to do is to go up and go back and then find 0.2%, but it's much simpler not to do that forward reverse experiment, but just to extrapolate back with the initial slope, even though that I think people know that that's wrong, but that's just the simple engineering test to perform. Otherwise, you have to go forward and back many times in order to get precisely to the point that gives you 0.2%. Okay. So one of the questions, and we heard a little bit about that at the end of the discussion last time, is, you know, you have this curve, which clearly is not a straight line. How much of that is due to that curvature is due to actual plastic deformation? How much of it is due to just anelastic or anharmonic behavior, et cetera? Okay? And
there. What would a curve like this look like for Crystal if you knew you were below the threshold for dislocation?
It would be linear.
Linear, book slow.
Well, there'd be some anelasticity.
There's always some.
Yeah.
So Crystal, that's more. I mean that, you know, that's not a, you know, that up to the red line there, that's a tiny anomaly.
Well, so here's
as a huge deformation. I mean, 1% is an enormous strain.
Well, here's PMMA, right? So here's, this is experiments, and you know, there's in amorphous materials, you do tend to be able to go to very large strains. Unless you get localized deformation, which you do in some cases, but in polymers you often don't. So you can, for crystals, usually dislocations would set in much sooner. If you could make them dislocation free, which you can on the computer, then you could also get into this regime and actually see more linear than what I've shown here.
In polymers, the scale on the strain axis is larger than the system.
Yeah, I mean, here you have 20%, right? And this is partly related to strain hardening and other things that tend to limit the runaway of the of instabilities.
But the yield strain's only 5 to 10% in polymers, as the diagram shows, so it's really not that big, right? That's why the polymer part doesn't make much difference.
Well, so yes, you're right that the reason it doesn't care about the covalent bonds is that not much has happened at this point. But if you were looking for a lot of experimental systems, they would fail at strains of 1% and 2% in some brittle
hard
manner.
Materials, you're
amorphous glass, amorphous metals, right?
Yeah, so most crystalline metals yield at about 1% elastic strain. Most metallic glasses yield at about 2% elastic strain, which is twice as high, and polymers.
So 6 or 7 is bigger than 2.
Yeah.
We're all
perturbative. I don't know if we want to get so mathematical with this. It's within an order of magnitude.
Right. Within an order of magnitude.
It's a factor of 3 among friends, right?
Okay. So one of the questions has been, so one thing you can ask is, if you didn't just do this linear extrapolation, but actually really did the backwards trend, how would the remaining strain depend upon the applied strain? And this just shows that the experimentalists were arguing that the residual strain would extrapolate to zero, that there'd really be no deformation below some applied strain. And this shows in the simulations that for the smallest applied strains that we can look at, we always see that there's some unrecoverable, some permanent strain produced by the applied strain. Something irreversible has happened, okay? And the
irreversible on the short time scale.
Yeah,
the last part of that is an elasticity. It will disappear if you wait.
Well, is that so?
I would say so, yeah.
Your irreversible strain is much smaller than what you get with the extrapolation, right?
That's right. So first of all, this initial curvature here, okay, extrapolating back would have given a much bigger residual strain. This is really going fast. And
what about it comes back?
Well, it's not, I mean, you're saying that over time it would relax to zero, and I disagree.
Well, so
what is the evidence? Well, that depends upon what the age of the initial glass was and whether it was, you know, well aged or not at well aged, right? So there's no guarantee that it wants to go back to the original state that you started.
If initially it was not well aged, then maybe similarly.
So, but I guess the question is, how long did you wait in your simulations to see?
Your
well, I mean,
Well, if you look at this particular temperature, it's low enough that nothing would have happened. Okay, but we've also looked with the polymeric systems. It turns out for a polymeric system, if you start from a equilibrium polymeric system and you stretch it and then relax it partially, you have some chain orientation, which is a non-equilibrium property, and it will eventually decay. Okay?
To zero.
If you wait long enough. Now, in both our simulations and in experiments, you never see that relaxation occur until you go above the melting temperature in any of the system. So again, I can't simulate as long as people can experiment, but it's been done in experiments for polymer glasses, and you know, over periods of months, it retains that orientation. Okay. So no way anybody's going to simulate to compete with that. Yeah.
Do you have a curve that shows your unloading stress strain curve?
Not here.
Oh, okay.
It's more or less along.
It's actually interesting. If you go beyond the 1% or 0.2%, whatever this red triangle you draw. The unloading curve, even around that point, become nonlinear.
Yes.
Coming down and curved back, like what you show on the loading curve.
Yes. So, they are. Yeah, the unloading curves are nonlinear.
Right. So the main question is that caused by this viscoelasticity elasticity or anything else?
I wouldn't call it viscoelasticity because it's not rate dependent. In any sort of way that we're doing it here. It really is just that there is a component of the response that is nonlinear. I mean, that's the linear is the first part in harmonic expansion, and there's no reason that you would expect when you're going up to the point where things are becoming unstable and minima are disappearing, right? You don't expect to see the first order harmonic approximation to work all the way up to that point. So experiments also show that it's nonlinear.
Experimentally, for most of the metallic glass, you have a very linear elastic region, very small, and at room temperature, you go up to almost to the point it fails.
Which is still fairly small for metallic glasses.
Small, actually zero.
Becomes nonlinear also.
One all the time.
You recover 80%, we talk about energy which you can store, the mechanical work you put into the system here in your stress strain experiment, 80% can be recovered. 80%. That is the number.
80% of the elastic strain.
Of the mechanical work you put in the system, you create your sample down the metallic glass, and you do it in the DSC run, how much entropy comes out again, it's 80%. It's a very nice slope. Yeah. Just put the reference on the wiki space.
When you say 80%, what total strain?
Up to the yield stress.
Okay.
Afterwards, you stay state. Your amount of energy you recover is constant. Okay. You have a steady-state flow there.
Up to the second yield stress, green dot.
The green dot.
Right, so you're saying anywhere along here it would always be 80%?
But keep in mind, metallic glass is the response is much different than what you're showing here. It's nonlinear, but it's more linear.
It's more linear, it's right, but it's not linear at all. Okay, it's not linear.
But if you use Langer-Jones and other soft potentials, you always get this curve, always curve like this. You see this. That's something very interesting to think.
So we wanted to look at the rate of inelastic or rate of deformation. So here shows, again, shear stress versus strains. This is the same sort of plot, but different. And this is looking at the activity of deformations as a function of the strain or stress. And the way we defined these is we broke the system up into small regions, and we looked for changes, non-affine displacements above some threshold. So I guess it doesn't even say which is which on here, does it? One of the red or the blue is based on strain, and the other is based on stress, and it doesn't really matter. Okay, so the idea is that you look at either the shear stress in a little local region, or the deviation from an affine strain, and you see.
So that's on IJ of the macroscopic strain.
Yes. This would be the macroscopic strain, and so if things move definely, this would vanish, right? And so you look for things over some threshold, and you look at changes in the stress, and the point is that in yield, there'd be a more or less steady state value of that rate of little regions yielding, but even down to the very lowest strains, you see some sort of rise in activity. Okay, so we see, I wouldn't say that there's anything like a sort of constant rate. Maybe it's linear, but we weren't thinking so much about the very small behavior there. The other thing that I wanted to show is this, which shows a little bit about the coupling between stress and the rate of deformation. So this is looking as a function of temperature in an unstrained solid, okay? So instead of looking at the rate as a function of stress, we're just taking all the regions, and the regions have a volume containing a few particles, and we're looking over a fixed time interval, where this is the characteristic time of the Langer-Jones, and we're saying for all of the bins, what is the probability that we will see a change in the local stress tensor of a given magnitude, okay? And if we're at low temperature, not surprisingly, we don't see much change, okay? This behavior initially is just a phase space, right? You're very unlikely to have all the components of the stress be zero. So there's presumably something more or less like an exponential sort of decay, a Gaussian decay. As you increase the temperature, you get bigger and bigger events, okay? Or more likely to see larger and larger events. So clearly, you're seeing that temperature is increasing the rate of changes in the system, and maybe there's something like an exponential decay with a growing magnitude of those changes. So what happens if we increase the stress applied to the system? If we're at low temperature, right, as we increase the stress, and this is actually looking at, it's labeled by strain, so we're gradually going up to the yield strain in four equal steps, okay? And at each value of the strain, we're looking for a short interval of time at the rate of these changes, okay? So for 0.01, this would have been the equilibrium behavior, okay? And you can see that even at a quarter of the yield stress, you're getting an enhancement of the large events, okay? And as you increase the strain, eventually you get more and more large events. And the solid line here is the rate that is occurring in steady state, okay? So if you keep shearing for a large time, long time, at a constant stress, that's the asymptotic form. Okay. So what this clearly shows is what you might expect. As you strain the system, you decrease the energy barriers and you make it easier for thermal activation to take you over a barrier, and you increase the rate. And eventually, you reach some steady state where the distribution of barriers is unchanging as a function of strain. And thermal activity and strain or stress are both important in activating states. What I thought, yeah?
So the stress goes up and the yield then softens. So at that yield point, it should be above this steady state line, right?
Yeah, so this is at the yield point, and it's just above the steady state, yes. In this particular case, there was a little bit of strain, a peak and a little bit of strain softening. So, what if you go up near the glass transition temperature? So this, obviously there were a lot of big states. So here, we're up near the glass transition temperature, and the thing I want to point out is that near the glass transition temperature, it doesn't seem to be affected much at all by the applied stress, okay? So I'm looking at, you know, the quiescent state, I have the different stresses, and I'm pretty much seeing the same distribution independent of the applied stress.
Could you remind us back for the Cheska versus von Mises, were you that close to TG?
Yes. Some of them. I went from this temperature up to that temperature in there, and it doesn't, you know, everything in between.
Well, so if you artificially increase the strain rate tremendously, then you might come back to the low temperature behavior, right? Because rate scales with temperatures.
Yeah. So in this particular case, you know, we're going slowly for us, which of course is fast for an experimentalist. And we're looking at the rate, and we're seeing that it doesn't depend upon the applied stress, which I found sort of surprising, because this is the regime near the glass transition temperature that one often focuses on. And so let's, you know, there's a small change, but really very, very small. So to put this in context, if you look at the way that the yield stress depends upon temperature, and again, the binary Leonard-Jones and the polymer show very similar behavior, you get a rate dependence, and you also get a temperature dependence. And the temperature dependence is a nearly linear drop in the temperature, in the yield stress as a function of temperature. Okay? And you can see that as I go to lower and lower rates, the yield stress corresponding to 0.3 is effectively looking like it's going to go to zero. In other words, if I was going slowly enough at that temperature, that I wouldn't have a yield stress, that I'd be above the glass transition temperature, but I may have to go quite slow in order to see that. Okay?
What's 0.3 in terms of?
Well, it's in terms of the Leonard-Jones binding energy. And so you might choose to define the glass transition temperature by when this would extrapolate to zero at the lowest rate you could go to, okay? But, and then this 0.3 would be close to the temperature. But there's always some rate dependence, and it's always
is there an estimate of what do you want to call the glass transition temperature in the system?
If people have estimated 0.3, 0.35, you know. So this is very close to
TG. What TG would this be? I mean, the 10 to the 13, or the TC of MCT, or what?
This would be just the point on which, at the slowest I could go, it would appear. It appeared to not be fluid. Now, ten to the 14th is
out of steam.
What? It's when the simulation is running out of steam. That's right.
Which is perfectly fine. But so.
So I don't want to focus too much on what TG is for this and what the best way of finding TG. The main point I want to make here is TG is about 0.3 for many different ways you could try to estimate it, and. That
also from the liquid side?
Yes. So I can look at the viscosity as a function of strain rate, and it would appear to be rising very rapidly at this point.
But aren't you then surprised that the simulation, I think it's perfect how you define the TG in this paper. Why do your curves not depend on why don't you see TG? Because you know that above it's liquid and below it's effectively a solid. So something should happen at TG. So in the previous...
In our previous thing. So first of all, even for the polymer, right, at the rates that I've been looking at, I've been in the solid regime. I can't go slow enough to see that. I can just say, if I imagine extrapolating, it certainly looks like, you know, another decade and I'd be there, okay? So what we were doing here really is looking at the rate of relaxations in a system where even though at this particular strain rate, we would have a yield stress probably about here, okay? So we would say this is a solid with a yield stress. But as we approach that yield stress, we're saying the rate of transitions is not changing very much. And the main point I want to make is that if you're near the glass transition temperature, okay, we've also done this at 0.2 and 0.1, if you're near the glass transition temperature, the effective yield stress has already been reduced from the one that's associated with the energies in the problem by a large factor. In other words, thermal fluctuations just all around all the time are big compared to the energetic concerns. And in that limit, it shouldn't be too surprising that the stress on the system is going to have less effect than it would at low temperatures. I think we frequently think in terms of the low temperature limit and thermal activation, but near the glass transition temperature, there's so much bouncing around and so much activity anyway that's already dropped the yield stress, that I think thermal fluctuations can dominate changes due to stress in the rate of plastic activity. So that's really the goal of this this story. Yeah?
Yeah. How do you calculate your local stress density?
Well, in this particular case, we're using there. You can define a partition into a volume of space. Do you know about the virial contribution to the pressure stress tensor? So if you take the interaction between a pair of particles, you take the force and the outer product with the vector separating them, and that would be a contribution to the stress tensor. That line, then, you should take for every local region in space, you take the fraction of the line that's in that region and include that fraction in the stress tensor. And that's sort of the mechanism we use, which gives a well-defined stress tensor at even at small scales.
So actually, you provide us with a diagram, I wouldn't call it a phase diagram, between elastic and plastic regimes to determine on stresses and temperature, right? If you have this data now, you can draw
what we see
is versus temperature and versus stress, versus strain.
Well, I guess we would say that. You've confused me there. So this is the yield stress versus temperature and strain rate.
Strain rate?
Yes.
But Takeshi is talking about the yield stress actually between the elastic and plastic regimes.
But we see that there's always plasticity at any point.
Yeah, you should call it maybe I should call it global one. Yeah.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. So. So the last thing on the first half of the talk, is there a lecture on here? The introduction? Yeah, I'm about to start on that. So the other thing that I wanted to just show is the following. This is for a polymer, the stress as a function of, not the strain, lambda here is the stretch. So I imagine taking a cube and I stretch in one direction by a factor lambda, volume is conserved, it contracts in the other two directions or expands depending upon whether lambda is smaller or larger than one. And we get a curve that looks like this. This is the strain hardening that I mentioned. Everything I've talked about so far is down in here, where the fact that it's a connected polymer doesn't matter. Okay? So, this is the total measured stress. I can separate that into an energetic and a dissipative component, and that's cleanest in this case, which is a very low temperature simulation. So I can say what part of the stress is just coming from the potential energy stored in the system, right? So the derivative of the potential energy with respect to strain gives me a stress, which is purely energetic, and this is the total. And what you see is initially, the energetic term is a little lower than the total stress. And we've defined the difference between those as a dissipative stress.
So what's the dissipative mechanism in this
situation? Well, we just have a heat bath, and so basically any energy that gets put in will eventually flow to the heat bath. And the heat bath is a very gentle heat bath, so it doesn't influence the short time dynamics. And we're at it going slow enough that the temperature doesn't rise in any noticeable way. So this is the energetic term, and this is just the difference between those two. So you see that the part that's not going directly into the elasticity, if you had a nice linear stress strain curve, right, everything would be going into the elastic energy. and you can see that it's not, right? It's got a, there's a non-linear, there's a non-energetic part. It's not necessarily dissipative at this, in this limit. It could be flowing, you know, could be recoverable because we haven't reversed it. So the word may not be precise, but clearly it's not an elastic term. It's something anelastic at the very least. And you can see that initially the energy grows and eventually you've got sort of just flow and you're not putting any more potential energy into the system. So this has gone to zero. And mostly what you're doing is dissipating. So how should we think about this this non-energetic contribution to the stress? This is showing just this contribution for a long chain and a short chain, so short that it basically just acts like a normal amorphous material with a constant yield stress. Okay? And I've got, for each of those cases, two curves, a solid curve and a dashed curve. And you can see that the dashed curve follows along completely. Okay? So what's going on is the dashed curve is, sorry, actually in this case, the dashed curve is the dissipative stress and the solid curve is the rate of plasticity. The rate of plasticity being defined as the number of nearest neighbor bonds that break or change. In particular, we've chosen 20%. That turns out to be a big enough change. It's well outside the elastic limit. I could have chosen 15, 25. I can't choose much below 10 because that's the elastic regime. It's the rate of plastic bond breaking. And this is the rate of the contribution to the stress that's not energetic, that's dissipative, okay? And you can see that they track beautifully both the time fluctuations as well as the total values. Now, I should also say there's a constant, right? I have units that I have to convert from a rate of plasticity to a stress, okay? And basically, the same constant was used to multiply the two data sets for the two different length chains. And you can do it for different temperatures and other things. It's basically of order of binding energy and in terms of the energy dissipated per plastic event. And so clearly, the nearest neighbor bond breaking is directly related to the dissipation over the entire range. And again, that bond breaking starts out in a very sort of, you know, weak fashion and then rises more rapidly. The non-dissipative part of the stress does seem to have a small offset, and whether this is related to anything that
exactly. Well, how does that at the very beginning depend on your threshold? There presumably would be more bond breaking if you lowered your threshold on
those. Yeah.
It would, but not too much. I mean, it's very similar to when we look at omega and we look at the division between the elastic and the inelastic.
Might a reasonable criterion be to keep increasing delta R until it plateaus?
Well, it would go down, right? The number of events would go down as I make delta R. If you look at the distribution, you find that if you look at the histogram of delta R's, there's a huge peak that is sort of out to 10% that is basically just elastic strain. And then there's an exponential tail beyond that point. And so that's how this has been set, is by looking at the histogram of those. And you can also actually look at, you know, rearrangements and whether things are nearest neighbors, but again, that can be a little tricky. Okay.
Coming back to this, the bond breaking, we define bond breaking by crossing a threshold between first and second nearest neighbor, which is defined by minimum of PDF. And if you do that, this bond breaking
extrapolates to find a non-zero value, in fact, just like this dissipated, even at the zero strain. So that's what we are looking at.
Yeah. Now, and again, the a 20% change would certainly be big enough to go from first to second neighbor. It's about the same sort of, and yet our numbers of those rearrangements are very low. Okay, so I think it's not. But my expectation is that that would be highly sensitive to age of the glass. You say no?
Exactly, yeah.
Okay. But that this would be my expectation. And also, this is a very, very low temperature, and I don't know whether you were effectively at zero temperature. Effectively at zero temperature. So again, I would have thought that would be age dependent, but.
And does the blue curve depend on the sky height?
So neither of these depend much on the strain rate because we're at such a low temperature that thermal activation is irrelevant. And we've always been careful to go at a low enough strain rate that things like stress equilibration across the sample and other, the low temperature characteristic times associated with the low temperature behavior are all short compared to the times associated with the strain rate. So these are more or less rate independent. If you want to go slow enough that you would have thermal activation, which would affect these, then you'd have to go so exponentially slow that we can't address. Okay. So the next part of what I was going to tell you about is completely different. And I guess my tendency would be to see if people want to talk about this part now, and put, well, you know, I'm going to have a chance to talk about the other at the conference, and so why don't I, since this was originally going to be a discussion, let's discuss. Yeah. Well, we have someone who wants to discuss. Do you want? You want to
just to come back to the point that I discussed last time, I won't take too much time, but I would like to review what we are talking about. Last week, because many of you were not here, so.
Yes.
To make the story short, that it has been known for quite some time that if you have this glass, either reality or model, and then you apply a fine information, that is that all atoms deform with the same rate. If it is close, small amount. If it is far away, close more. So Ri prime, which is after deformation, is given by 1 plus epsilon Ri before, where epsilon is the strain tensor, but that is supposed to be uniform across. So changing the axis, for instance, if we define x to x prime and stuff like that, that's a fine deformation. And if you do that, you can calculate moduli such as B and G for the system easily by expanding energy to the second order and coefficient of the second order of this strain. If you expand the total energy and then the first first term is the actually strain, and second term actually is the, oh, this is like that. Of the moduli. And this one is it is zero in average, but if you look at local states, you see fluctuation in the strain, and therefore the stresses. And that what we call atomic level stresses. And the second one is the elastic moduli, which is not zero.
So that's a stress that's just defined macroscopically for the whole sample.
A strain is macroscopic.
Right.
Now, the response can be local, okay? In other words, if you apply uniform strain, the energy change at one locality and the other.
When you say one locality, you mean?
Nearest neighbor, right. Atomic level.
Oh, okay. So a strain associated with each atom.
Yes, exactly right. So if you explicitly write this strain, then this becomes one of that. That's the atomic volume, J of Fij alpha, Fij beta, where alpha beta are the Cartesian coordinate. That's the atomic level stress that we define. And again, this is the sort of, you know, atomic component of this guy. And if you average out for the whole system, you get zero, right? The pressure all over the place is zero. However, at each locality, some atoms are sort of pressured and some atoms are expanded. So you do have variation. Now, this elastic moduli is the same way. It's not the constant everywhere, but variation is smaller and it does not average out to zero. It comes to the finite value. So you get.
But can we just stop for a minute?
Sure.
This is assuming you're enforcing a
fine deformation without relaxation.
And is there any guarantee that it will be, that the average will be zero?
Oh, I see. No. No, but I mean, it's equal to the external stress. So this external stress.
But there's not always, you can't always do that without imposing body forces locally inside the material, right? So you're sort of violating.
Depends on the condition. Yeah, depends on the initial condition.
Well, I think the average is zero because you're starting with a relaxed state.
Right? Yeah.
So that the derivative of energy with respect to strain must be.
Exactly.
And that's only true if you're in the harmonic limit and you can.
It's just a derivative of energy with respect to
But you're not a relaxed. Is forcing an affine
deformation.
If I apply an affine deformation to a relaxed state, there's no guarantee the stress will be zero, which I thought is what he just said.
But
he said this term is average to zero.
The stress is defined as the coefficient in a linear expansion on the given state.
So relaxation means.
But for any finite strain.
Right. You have to extrapolate the strain.
Yeah. Exactly right. To zero, strain to zero, of course.
But because the first two terms are in expansion, right? The strain term is 40 terms in time.
Yeah. Exactly. So it's extrapolated to zero, of course. That's by definition.
An interesting thing here is that the strain tensor locally doesn't have to be isotropic. I mean, another strain tensor, the elastic tensor doesn't have to be isotropic.
Of course.
So, I mean, you can use this as a probe of local.
Exactly right. That's how we do. Yeah. We use both stress and strain, elastic constant, as a probe of local environment. Exactly right. But anyway, so if you calculate elastic moduli this way, you get these numbers. These are artificial, okay? Because you are imposing affine deformation, and you know, in reality, that's the case. If you relax this, it falls apart, right? Atoms move in different ways. So what happens if you allow relaxation to these values?
In looking at an expression like this, what are you supposed to be looking at? Are you supposed to be looking at the configurations with the particles in mechanical equilibrium or not?
No, it's not. So
no,
after
that's not what you're doing, but
right. It's a definition, just
Is it voice or void? I can't remember, but this is the, there's a exact upper bound for the elastic modulus of materials. And I can never remember whether it's voice or void, it's upper bound and lower bound. But this is, this is the upper bound modulus that we know that there will be a relaxation below if there's any non-uniformity in the material.
And that's born on one.
Yes.
1954. So if you do that, this state is, again, not stable, right? Not stable. So you allow some relaxation. That's 50% or something like that. What happens is that this one is largely unchanged. Okay?
And yeah, 3%, right?
But it doesn't change much.
So you define these macroscopic elastic modules by averaging.
That's correct.
Okay.
That's right. After averaging every site, volume. Yes, that's correct. So Kuroka is still varying, and the variation changes after relaxation, but the average value remains more consistent. However, the shear modulus goes down by 20 to 25%. There's a huge change in the shear modulus.
This is the 2D models?
No, 3D
models, yes. Of Leonard Jones? You're saying there's a very small change in the...
Right, it doesn't matter. These are pretty much independent of potential.
Okay. Yes.
Even when you do many body potential, it's about the same. So, and also, interestingly, that if you do experiment, if you compare the B and G of crystal, and then B and G of glass, of the same composition, then you find the same thing. So there are a lot of experimental.
Sorry, but the same thing, you mean the glass has about the same bulk modulus, but 25% lower shear modulus?
Exactly.
And so this is for a crystal that's got an isotropic shear modulus, because many crystals have non-isotropic shear modulus than 25%.
Yeah, of course. But many of them are cubic, so in that case it's nearly.
No.
All crystals have not had a proper shear modulus.
Yeah.
Okay, then if you average shear moduli. So this is a sort of rough statement, okay? And if you compile, say, these are published. So there are a lot of data, 30, 40 compounds. These have been done, compared for many glasses with crystals. In average, of course, in some cases more, in some cases less, right? But in average, you can unmistakable trend that B of crystalline glasses are similar, while shear modulus of glass is significantly lower. That's my statement.
There is a clear relax, the difference upon relaxing.
That's exactly right.
There is one explanation for the fact that B doesn't change much. There is one explanation for the fact that B doesn't change much, right? If you approximate the Leonard Jones interaction by a power law, which can be done in certain conditions, if you have a power law potential, when you just compress the system, you're just changing all the scales of the local distances between particles, and therefore when you do a fine compression, you don't change the overall force on each particle. So essentially, you go from one equilibrium configuration to another equilibrium configuration, and therefore you don't have non-defined contribution. So in this case, the Born approximation is exact for the compression modulus.
Yes. If you apply pressure, the configuration doesn't change much.
You're saying basically, if you compress, the system continues to remain in mechanical equilibrium.
Right.
In the case of
this, it's somehow the exact, or something like we change Anderson with the blood pressure.
Right.
Anyway, that's about
okay. I mean, of course, you have the same effect already in crystals when you put in defects.
That's correct.
I mean, it is known for closed packed materials. If you put in interstitial defects, you get per atom, per interstitial, and minus 40 times the shear modulus with a minus. And that is because it comes polarized. Those defects are very highly polarizable. So I mean, it just can turn. It turns with a huge amplitude in direction of shear.
Exactly.
Like, of course, with compression, it doesn't do anything.
Exactly.
So the effect of pressure is isoconfigurational. So yeah, first of all, zero goal. Okay. However, that the effect of shear stress and strain is catastrophic. And that's the essence, essentially, the message.
Well, not necessarily.
Let me finish. Okay, let me finish. So anyway, I'm just saying there's a big difference between these two. Okay, that's I think everybody agrees, right? There's a big difference, fundamental difference. This doesn't change symmetry. This does. Now, so we looked at the origin of this change in the elastic modulus, or shear modulus. Why does it change so much? And one paper published earlier by Dennis Ware says that that's because the local, this one is indeed inhomogeneous, right? Elastic constant is not homogeneous. Therefore, that some atoms move more and some atoms move less, etc. And that sounds right, but in case of crystalline defect that was mentioned, in this case, it's really like a vacancy where the density goes to down to zero. But in glasses, this density fluctuation is like 10 or that.
So I didn't talk about the vacancy. Mm-hmm. Interstitialized.
Yeah, the same thing. density increases like factor of
100%. I mean, the total density doesn't make much difference.
100%. So, but I mean, density fluctuation in glasses are smaller, and then this effect is small. Instead, what we found is that this tracks very well with the bond breaking, which we defined to be sort of the function is like that. So we arbitrarily make a cut between first nearest neighbor as a cutoff radius. And if atoms move from this to that or this to that, then we say in this case bond is broken, and in this case bond is formed. So it isn't an arbitrary deviation, but it's, you know.
But can I stop you?
Yeah.
So everything you're talking about over here is really within linear response, right? So
no,
you should be thinking
no.
About, well,
it's
then,
sort of linear, but the
but if linear modulus is linear response, right?
No, the real punchline is that it's not linear at the end of the day. It's apparently linear, okay? And if you do macroscopic measurement of strain and stress, it's linear. But microscopic, not. So if
you mean it's not linear microscopically, after you allow relaxation.
I'll come down.
But the original point they point thing can make things.
By definition, right. The definition it's linear. Okay. But if you the process of relaxation breaks this linearity.
But this is four strains where it looks linear if you make a stress strain like
that's exactly right. So we're talking about way below 1%. So what we found is that total number of bonds does not change much, okay, in range pretty much the same. But there are some bonds which are broken or formed. And this is the bond breaking, number of bond breaking versus strain. Surprisingly linear. This is a part which you disagree, but we have to, you know, do more careful comparison of note, but I mean that's what we got. So, even for small strain,
you get some bond broken. This is because even after relaxation, the structure is not in a deep trough. So you know, there are always some unstable bonds which are just hanging on. And these guys get tripped.
What do you the scale?
Yeah.
In terms of scale?
Yes, I'll give you. So it's about 1%. And the number of bonds.
But it's more strange. So the bonds that break are breaking actually atoms that are moving from somewhere near that first peak to somewhere near
the second peak?
That's
the definition, yes. That's right. So many of them move like the half an angstrom. But even for a small string,
so you only count it as a broken bond if it's not anything that's below your RC moving to anything that's above your RC.
Well, that's what it is.
That's what it is. Okay. So, but then it could be that a lot of that at small strains, the bonds that are breaking are moving.
It's not going to be. Not just here.
No.
Right. So. If you're way down here, and the bonds that you're counting as breaking were bonds that were over here, and they're just moving to over there, then it's not linear.
No, it's not.
How do you know?
Because this is much more than that. This number.
This value is very deep. So you know how much. And also, we looked at each individual atoms.
Okay.
And each individual displacement is typically half an angstrom. It's not an ideal thing.
You mean if you take the broken bond, you say what's the average?
We classify it to these two classes.
Yes. Okay.
And the displacement is relative to the neighbors or relative to the inertial frame?
Original position. So there's neighbors move too.
So but relative, not relative to the affine displacement.
Relative to the affine.
Because you can get very large non-affine displacements without having large relative displacements.
I know.
But that's
a collective, by if a center moves collectively.
Yeah.
No, that's not what I'm talking about.
So the case
is that change.
The case.
Yeah, but the change from here to here. So this is relative, okay, in that sense. Well, in a sense, yes. It's therefore that the diffusion is by. Relative.
Relative.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I thought you started out sort of trying to make some comparison.
Right. Yeah, I'll come to that. So, So that means that non-elastic events are happening already at a very small strain. Therefore, that this explains this effect. In other words, that the amount of number of bonds cut and strain produced is reasonable.
As soon as you put the thresholds, even in the elastic response, you will see some bond breaking, you know, corresponding to the thresholds, because you have some bonds which are very close to the threshold. Yeah.
He's saying that if you look at the statistics of bonds that break, if you actually look at say how far they
much
move,
more than that.
He's saying they move a big distance.
Yeah. Much more than that.
Yeah.
So reversible?
No, not reversible. But most of them are fast. So most of them are reversible. So strictly speaking, put it this way, that what happens is that usually some bonds are broken on the way back, some other bonds are formed up there at a different place. So altogether, it looks more reversible than it is now. It is unelastic.
Reversible on average?
Yes, reversible on average. So you know that they represent the fast process. When you say elastic measurement, we really have to worry about the strain rate, because there are a lot of fast processes in the system at finite temperature, up to the phono frequency, up to 10 telohertz. Right? So actual strain you see is the integration of kilowatt tau, or my, I'm sorry, minus one minus that. Minus that. Yeah. One minus E2 minus kilowatt tau.
tau. And essentially, that any tau which is faster than the experimental time scale recalls. I'm sorry, it's not 1 minus, right? So that's when they make a difference. So this, if you just calculate epsilon itself, this is just that. So anything, if a tau is. No, I'm sorry, it is correct. I'm sorry. So if you know, tau is much shorter than t, then this event occurs anyway, almost elastically. She's so fast that it looks elastic, but it is in reality, it's unelastic.
But it's not, it would be inelastic, it would be detectable in two ways. First of all, if you look at a forward-backward curve, you should see that there's been some dissipation. The other thing you can do is you can measure the potential energy of the system, and that's exactly our dissipative stress. If you take the modulus, right, and you assume that there's no plastic rearrangements, then you can calculate the energy from the modulus. So if the observed slope doesn't give you the change in energy, which is what we found, then you've got these jumps.
Yeah. If there's a fast relaxation event, the dissipation factor is only around that frequency of 1/10, right?
So can somebody explain exactly what the point at which there is a dissipation? I'm lost at this point. What is the statement that's being questioned?
So I guess the first number, there's I think a couple of interesting questions that other people I think may also have opinions on. Jean-Louis, I know, has looked at this. One is, how much do the local elastic properties, the shear modulus locally, how much does it vary? My understanding is many people have seen very large local variations. If that's the case, you would not expect the shear modulus to be near the upper bound. You would expect it to be reduced from the upper bound by a large amount and seeing a 25% drop without any plastic rearrangements would not be surprising. So I think one interesting question is, in a purely elastic limit of the glass, how much does the normalization from the relaxation relative to the affine displacement affect the modulus? So I think that's one interesting question, and maybe we could have a brief discussion of that. And then there's a second question, which is, if there are non-elastic relaxations, bond breaking, bond rearrangements, how many of them are there as a function of strain? And I think we see different behavior there. And how important are they to this reduction in the modulus? I think those are the two questions that I think are.
So on the second question now, you see, I mean, it's what the case is saying, qualitatively different from what other people have seen, or because he said that on average, I mean, I don't know what the scale on your plot there is of NBB, because if there's something minute, maybe there is no.
Well, but it has to be big enough to explain the 25% reduction. So there's that.
No, but this is not clear to me because you said there are two possible sources of why the 25% could arise. And in principle, in what he is reporting also, both of those effects are in operation. This happens to be also true.
That's right.
But we don't know what those numbers are. I mean, it's if you, how many bonds are broken on that scale there?
Well, so each bond produces a strain of about 8%.
So he is in fact saying that number of broken bonds is enough to explain the strain, and that you can assume the upper bound modulus with extra strain given by the plastic deformation to explain the 25% reduction.
And certainly the rate of plasticity we're seeing is nonlinear and wouldn't be sufficient to explain that. But he's saying with no, as I understand it, you're saying with no variation in the modulus, with no elastic contribution, you could explain
by,
with this.
No, yeah? That is by fitting this number. So that's not what we're saying. It is consistent
with that experiment.
I'm not saying that's the only yield process.
It's certainly true that both of these things are operative, right?
Yeah.
We should expect that if it's amorphous, there's both elastic, and we know there's
inelastic
relaxation.
Linear in the strain.
Local shear modulus distributes down to zero.
Okay. So that's one
that
I think is the key.
Right, there was one talk that was relevant,
spots.
Maybe relevant earlier, though maybe only tangentially relevant, which was that Corey O'Hearn had come earlier,
exactly.
And he was talking about the jamming systems,
exactly.
Which are different in an important way in that they typically don't have an attractive part to the interaction. And he was pointing out that when he took his systems and tried to use linear response to predict things like this, he found that the regime in which linear response mattered was infinitesimally small.
I strongly recommend
now that could. Is that, am I remembering
correctly? Yeah, that's correct. But this relates to the question that was asked earlier about whether the bond breaking you're looking at is moving beyond some threshold in the G of R, right? In Corey's case, the idea was that there were always going to be a large number of particles near the jamming threshold, which were near the cutoff. Right. So any change would take
a lot of
particles.
Even though nothing moved there.
Right. So that's not.
Well,
so,
but,
no,
then,
no,
but
no,
if
no,
you
but
were trying to predict the behavior
by
linearizing things around that point, right, you were getting some spurious answer, right? So
right.
Because
right.
Once you got past that point, they were totally unconnected
right.
And
exactly.
Couldn't move anywhere.
Yeah, so he,
right.
he was talking about the change in the contact network.
Mm-hmm.
As being for even for invertible movements of particles as the reason for why that the domain of harmonic approximation being valid being smaller.
And I also showed you data showing that at the smallest displacements there was plasticity, but it's highly nonlinear, and so to some degree. I think everyone agrees.
Yeah.
You can see plasticity at very small strains. And the bigger the system, the smaller the strain in which you see them, right? And I guess the question is, how big quantitatively is that effect at small strains, and how does it scale with strain?
If I'm not saying you did right, you said something earlier about doing a steepest descent relaxation. That's very different from what you're doing. You're doing by temperature. But your things can actually hop over barriers. Yours can't. You did I think you right earlier? You said that you first applied this affine strain, and then you allowed the system to relax by steepest descent. Right?
Yeah.
So you're not going to go over any barriers.
If you cool
I'm just trying to say this announcement, but you didn't. What Mark?
I also showed data basically zero temperature with.
You mean the 0.01?
Yeah, it's basically the same.
That's right. So I think that what's happening is that at high temperature you have a lot of fluctuation in topology. Changing all the time. But then it freezes into a fixed topology of EG. And when it does, always some unstable bonds are sort of frozen. At a very precarious state, if everybody's running, and then say stop, something like that. Right?
that's a young quench system, right?
Yeah. Maybe digs a little bit of hole, but anyway, essence is that there are lots of these. You know, maybe I think it comes to now. Yes, by digging a hole, it becomes less. But the essence is that there are a lot of these unstable configurations. Frozen in the liquid, in the glass, and that is the crux of the matter. And in our estimate, I also gave last week talk about the experimental results from diffraction, and which we estimate the density of such an unstable state to be 25%. It's huge. I'm not just talking about few atoms.
26 to 25% is the amount by which this applies to the system yields?
Yeah, exactly. So that's, so my picture is that, you know, there are a lot of pond in which, essentially, which are unelastic. So if you apply some by shear, then they will yield, essentially, without any some, you know, any resistance. Right? So the shear elastic resistance is carried by 75% of the body.
So let me put it another way. Would you predict that the unrecoverable strain after going out would be 25%?
No, because most of them were recoverable, because the tau is fast. With, you know, relaxation time is fast, it comes back.
Wait, but I thought we're at zero temperature, so what's the relaxation mechanism that brings you back?
Well, at the finite temperature.
But your simulations were zero temperature. So I just don't understand.
Okay. The steepest descent always gives you some relaxation. And let's separate
but
simulation
did,
from
yeah.
Simulation from simulation is very old, okay? It's 1985, published in 85. So it was done long time ago, and maybe it should be redone. But still, actually, we did recently the groundbreaking experiment. And numbers are, right, numbers are similar indeed, yes, in world terms. So we'll do this as a function of temperature. But the fact is that there are a lot of unelastic which are soft, right, which I think you agree, that which are not carrying the elastics stress. So on top of this, what Mark said about this, unelastic event that after heavy deformation, even before it happens at the equilibrium at strain zero, there are a lot of fast unelastic events, which experimentally look like elastic, but it is not. I think that's a key on the system, and that's indeed Coriolis system and glass. Even though superficially they are very different, but they are very similar in a sense that there are a lot of precarious states left in the system, and that's an important point.
Doesn't that seem at odds with your statement that there's a very deep valley at your RC? I mean, you would think if you had a bunch of atoms quenched into highly non-equilibrium states, then you would expect that
this
would
two body.
Yeah.
This is two body.
Right, but you'd expect to see it as a stuff stuck in the
lots of squares. It just goes sideways.
Right. So Takesh, this number 25%,
yeah.
I mean, so are you saying that supposing I'm thinking of a covalent glass, right, which is probably sort of the best kind of system to look at to sort of have a network picture? So if you make a small deformation, you're saying 25% of the bonds are
broken.
So this is what so just to be clear, I mean, if they reform, how many bonds change when you make a small deformation according to what you're saying?
In covalent system, we have to redefine the unit of motion.
Yeah,
it
would be better to plot the fraction of bond.
It's a few percent, maybe 10% or so.
10% at what?
At 1% strain.
At which epsilon is it 10%?
Let me see. I have to recall.
I think that's probably where there could be different expectations from people. I mean, if there is a media increase in the number of broken bonds with increased strain, probably nobody's surprised.
No,
it's just the scale.
So Cassie, I'm wondering if you could get that number and put it on the wiki.
Yeah.
Because I think people are all hanging on their.
It is on the wiki system. It would be expensive.
Well, just a point for clarification. When you say elastic, your idea is that locally you have some bistable configuration, right? So that, to me, that's a, the problem is that, I mean, John, we first, when you looked at this, this non-affine response, you looked in the actually truly linear response. I mean, by looking at strains which were the
If you take your system small enough that there are no bistable events, and you already
you still have the 25%. So that's the point. So the point is that you already have 25%. When you are rigorously mathematical in a response.
So you mean we're talking about a system where you apply the 8-point strain, you relax it, nothing moves very far, and you still see a reduction of the shear margin.
It's more than that, is that you can actually do this in the linear mathematical linear response, which means that your displacements can be infinitesimally small. And you still have the 25%.
So you see a 25% reduction of the shear modulus from what you get when you first apply the 8-point stress to what you get after you relax.
Mm-hmm. Right. We got nothing more.
Yeah. Yeah. Just because the local environment has a variation.
Can I say something? In the old literature, of course, both effects were known. One was called diaelastic, the other one paraelastic. So you have one effect that is the one which you saw. Is of course that some atoms polarize heavily and they move. That is diaelastic effect. But then you have another effect. If you have some group of atoms, we can go from one minimum to another. Now you put strain on, the thermal occupation number changes, and because of course the forces in one minimum are different from the other one, you get another purely elastic effect. So which is called paraelastic, and which actually internal friction people even use to determine defect structures.
Yes, but this second defect is dissipated.
Yeah, the second one depends on temperature, of course, because you have to be able to go over the. It's elastic in the thermodynamic limit. If I wait infinite time, then I would get it. But it depends on temperature.
But you're saying you don't need to invoke events like that to explain 25%.
Sorry.
So you're saying that. Yeah, 25% is really all there.
Zero temperature or variable temperature, you can strictly disentangle the two effects. If you start with a finite temperature, then you have a contribution to the elastic modulus that comes from both of them.
Yeah.
And you have a contribution to the internal friction or dissipation that comes only from the second effect.
But it seems like the first effect explains the shear modulus. You see the full 25%.
Right. Oh, yes, right. In terms of reduction of the draw of the shear modulus.
So the second
non-affine
apparently is not very important.
Well, I mean, if you're interested
for
in
for the shear modulus.
But if you're interested in the other friction, it's very important.
But the other way, I mean, if you were to do the linear, fully linear theory, that would make a prediction for how the energy of the system, the relaxed energy, would change with strain. Right, and any of the sort of plastic rearrangements would give you would differ from that. That's the quantity again that we had looked at directly, and could be looked at in your simulations as well. But I don't think has been. But I'm just saying that's a
finite temperature. It's not energy, but it's free energy.
But at zero, at effectively zero temperature, which is where the simulations were done, it's okay.
I think So and also if you are looking of course at higher strains, if you want to explain what the fact that you see a strongly non-linear elastic response, that of course might include this type of reversible changes.
In that limit, yes.
Okay, maybe if you go to
see them, yes. I think it's really just whether the initial response. Right, from point you were seeing from say 0.2%, 0.3% that behavior was affected by the plasticity. And if really 25% are that close to being unstable, that would be.
Yeah. Or that, for instance, near the yield point, there will be a lot of plastic deformation already, right? And also at the near PG, there will be a lot of that.
Thank you.
But is it really sufficient to say that if we do Jean-Louis' procedure simulation and we get the 25%, does that really tell us that the 25% that we see in experiment, even at relatively small strains, is entirely coming from this elastic relaxation? Because, I mean, I'm just worrying, since these results that Corey showed, where he puts on a very small strain and it destroys the minima that he was in.
And the challenge part is relatively extreme case.
Right.
Actually, G is essentially going to zero much faster. I mean, when you go to point J, the shear modulus is going to zero much faster than the bulk modulus. So it's relatively extreme, where the world of the response becomes very large, even for.
Not all of the systems he was showing were at point J. They were the jamming type systems, but they were not.
No, but I think whether you have an interaction potential that's purely repulsive or not will make a fundamental difference. I don't think there is anything like a point J to sort of talk about when you have also attractive
It's irrelevant.
Takeshi's claim, though, was that perhaps when you quench these systems, even though they have an attractive part, you end up with a lot of
unstable states
of atoms that are in sort of very shallow minima.
That's right.
That could be easily destroyed.
No, that's certainly true, but you don't have the kind of marginality that's associated with point J.
I'm not sure.
I don't think the behavior he was seeing was because he was near point J. I think he was seeing it because he had non-attractive finite range interactions. But I don't think the systems he was looking at were the ones at point J.
We've looked at the stuff I showed you was with and without attractive interactions, and there's always plastic rearrangements at strains.
That's right.
But the strain you need to go to see them, right, depends upon systems.
Yeah.
So we need to have, I mean, I was doing simulations with 500,000 particles, but a lot of those, and then, you know, a fraction of a percent, you see something, but there's, in order to see things at 0.2%, I actually would have needed to have very large systems. And I think, so Corey sees instabilities. We do attractive, non-attractive.
Okay, so that's
my belief and our experience is those depend heavily at low strains, heavily on age of the sample, that the age can affect the linear response as well as the amount of plasticity at small strains. And so it just would surprise me if there was a universal number of 25% that was independent of age.
So even when you have these sort of rearrangements that because of which you may, for example, get these broken bonds, in principle, I mean, these could be two-level systems which are reversible upon reversible of
down
the strain, the global strain, right?
Mm-hmm.
So this, is there a clear understanding of this? I mean, so in other words, I mean, they're not sort of strictly dissipative, but they are dissipative to the extent two-level systems.
They're dissipative capacity. They still be dissipative.
Huh?
They would still be potentially dissipative.
Yes, but, you know, dissipative, but not irreversibly.
Not irreversible.
So,
so in Corey's case, because of this very topological potential is quadratic up to this point and zero. So the second derivative of potential is a step function. You get finite force until then and become zero. And because of this topological situation, you have this distribution of potential energy like that. I don't know it, but it's exactly like that. But anyway, it has a very, very large number of this system here. And then I agree with Robin that with the attractive system, it shifts upwards. So it comes back like this. So the question is whether this goes to, you know, finite or zero, right? And my contention is that it does, like you said, it connects to the two-level system. Two-level system here. And if you take a certain time scale, like, you know, experimental time scale, the amount of activation energy which is activated within the time scale, like a second or so, is quite large. You know, you can overcome a lot of activation energy system within the experimental time scale of a few seconds. So you don't have to go all the way, but you know, there are a lot of systems involved. And then that must be the one that we're looking at by the experiment. This is not a simulation, this is an experiment, and then we come with a number of, you know, movable or anelastic events or densities between 5% and 24%.
Okay, and just many people weren't here, but as I remember it, the way the experiment was analyzed was to take the GR, the pair correlation function, and try to fit that into an affine and a non-affine part. Right. There was no direct measurement of plastic activity, is that correct?
Right. This is the pair distribution function going anisotropy, okay? So we look at just anisotropy component, which really describes this change, not the total PDF. For PDF changes only a little bit, okay? But if you take an anisotropy part of PDF, it's very, very sensitive.
Wait, before you do some serial homography.
Yes, it's very homography expansion. And then if you do that, the two term is very sensitive to this change. And if you do that, then we can analyze this in terms of the elastic affine change and unelastic change, which the
elastic defines anything other than the affine.
That's right.
Anything which would include the other relaxation.
Yes, that's right. And we do experiment.
So we know there's nonlinear. So you can say.
It is nonlinear. So we do pre-creeping experiment to determine this unelastic PDA and analyze this total PDA. We can say that affine term plus unelastic PDA. So that's the way that it became the number. So, you know, you may debate the number 25% 24%, but anyways, is there, the point is there are substantial unelastic component, even in the apparently linear portion, like, again, 0.5% or even less. This was done for elastic region, okay? Before yielding, way before yielding, you already see unelastic events happening in the system.
We should continue this discussion in the line.
Yeah.
Just a question.